Hallito and welcome to Native Chalk Talk, a podcast by Natives for all. Here we're keeping our Native ancestors' stories and history alive, while also sharing with you our Native culture, traditions, and more. I'm Rachel Youngman, a Choctaw originally from Anadarko, Oklahoma. I hope you'll enjoy this journey with me as we learn from our Native American guests. And I hope you'll do me a favor. Feel free to like and share these episodes. I so appreciate it. Yakuki. In the early 1900s, they were admired for their stunningly vivid colors, and they were traded for their ever so essential warmth and durability. And they were buried with those who had passed. They were and are the one and only Pendleton blankets, and they're more than just a means to stay warm. They're a part of our Native American history. Listeners, when I say the word Pendleton, you may hold the thought of these beautiful blankets near and dear to your hearts as you cozy into them on a cold winter's night, or you may wonder why blankets with Native American patterns are not manufactured by American Indian corporations. So let's talk about it. Please welcome my guest today, Barry Friedman, a historical expert, buyer, trader, and seller of vintage Pendleton blankets. In fact, Barry sold 50 period Pendletons for the filming of Martin Scorsese's movie, Killers of the Flower Moon. Barry, welcome to Native Chalk Talk.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I also have to give a quick shout out to a lovely lady named Kathy Fuss from University of Oklahoma who introduced us. Yakuki, Kathy. Folks, Barry is out of Phoenix, Arizona, and has been collecting and supplying these 100-year-old Pendletons since 1969. He has helped design shoes with UGG, a snowboard with Burton, and many other collaborations over the years. Barry is also the vintage blanket consultant to Pendleton Woolen Mills, and Ralph Lauren himself has been a customer of Barry's for over 30 years. He also sells museum-quality blankets to private collectors and has been instrumental in helping to form the most important collections in the world. Barry has lectured all over the country and is an appraiser, consultant, and seller of these Pendleton blankets. He's also author of Chasing Rainbows, Collecting American Indian Trade and Camp Blankets, and its sequel, Still Chasing Rainbows. Now, in addition to this expertise, Barry, you also have worked in comedy, correct?
Yeah, I was a professional comedy writer for several decades. Yeah, I did it jointly. While I was writing comedy, I was still, collecting, buying and selling blankets. It sort of kept me sane. So
yeah,
it was a good
thing. I mean, it's always good to have to diversify, right? And have various talents.
Well, yeah, and if you're spending your day with professional comedians, they're all highly neurotic. So you need something that, sort of brings you back down to reality. You know, when you're hanging around famous people all day that have this insane idea about their importance to the world, sometimes it's nice to just, look at an old blanket and go, oh, okay, this needs some repair. Well, it's actually really fun because, first of all, writers, and I think I typified this today, writers can be horribly dressed and they can be overweight. They can be, absolutely ludicrous in their personal life. But if they can write a joke that a comedian likes, then they find employment. So yeah. You spend all day basically laughing with someone famous. And at the end of the day, they give you a check and they feed you all day as well. So you can't you can't hardly believe that someone's handing you a check for, nonsense. And it's great. It's like the best job. The bad job is being the comedian, that goes out there and, that is scary to me. I could never do that.
Oh, so. Same. Yeah. Well, and it's definitely not nonsense in that really comedy makes the world go round. So we appreciate what you did and do. Also, I know you've been a little bit modest. I will brag on you a bit. Barry has received 6 Emmy nominations, wrote a nationally syndicated newspaper column for 6 years, and hosted a radio program for several years. He's appeared in hundreds of publications ranging from USA Today and the Los Angeles Times to the Antique Trader, and has been profiled on television programs such as Good Morning America. And now those of you who own and love your Pendleton blankets, by the end of the show with Barry, I'll have an ask of you that I'm excited about. So stay tuned for that, listeners. I'm excited about today's conversation where we're going to talk about the history of Pendleton blankets and the American Indian, and we'll learn about the various types of blankets and more. But before we do, I'd like to hit a particular subject head on. There are some who feel that both Native Americans and non-natives should only buy products with Native patterns on them from American Indian-owned corporations. And of course, I constantly encourage people to shop Native. I'm a big fan of Native-owned companies like 8th Generation who are making beautiful work. So please go look into 8th Generation as well if you get a chance. However, in the case of Pendleton, I'd like to encourage you to listen to the history and the story of Pendleton, even if it's just to learn more. I think you'll find it interesting.
I've been thinking about it, as you said, since 1969, and I've written huge amounts of material on them. And so I've devoted a lot of time and energy to this. And I want to make clear, I don't work for Pendleton. I advise them. So I'm not speaking for the company. I can speak about the company, and I think without reservation. So I'm giving you my personal view and not the corporate view of Pendleton. What people don't understand, I think, primarily is, number one, when we talk about Pendleton blankets, that is a generic term because there were many companies besides Pendleton that made blankets for what was termed the Indian trade. And the first company was actually a company called J. Capps and Sons. And they were located in Jacksonville, Illinois. And they made the very first Indian pattern trade blankets in 1892. Pendleton did not begin until 1896. They went belly up in 1908. So the factory was idle. And then a family named Bishop, who still owns the company today, bought the idle company, resurrected it, and have been making blankets with Indian patterns since 1909. So, excuse me for being long-winded, but I think what most American Indians don't understand is the patterns themselves. Because they've grown up with them, they have decided that they're American Indian by osmosis. They see them every day. Their parents had them, their uncles had them, their grandparents had them. But they weren't around when these patterns were devised. And they were devised all by white people, you know, just Caucasian people going, okay, I don't know. Let's see if this sells. You know, we have to remember this is a product. The primary designer for Pendleton that made all their famous patterns, even to this day, the Chief Joseph is their best-selling pattern of all time. Their second best-selling pattern is the Harding pattern. Those were both designed by the same man. His name was Joseph Rounsley. And Pendleton has saved very little in the way of artifacts or their history. But right. They do have Joseph Rounsley's library. And I've seen it. And it's all European books about geometric patterns, which is what these blankets have. He didn't have a single book on American Indian culture. None. So I think that's an important thing to know. These are geometric patterns. But because American Indians have lived with them and seen them for so long, they have, and I don't blame them, they've decided they're American Indian patterns. I don't know that that's necessarily true.
Right. So it sounds like what you're saying is there was a designer who didn't spend time with Native Americans nor even owned a book of their culture. And he would design these geometric patterns, and it kind of turned into what we see today with the Pendleton blankets. We have adopted some of that as part of our Native American artwork. Is that correct?
I think that's the concept I'm trying to convey, that they have been part of American Indian culture for so long that people just assume that these are American Indian patterns that the modern version of Pendleton is regurgitating and making money from the American Indian culture because they're, you know, cultural appropriation. Again, I'm not speaking for Pendleton. Pendleton nor any of these other companies have never used American Indian sacred symbols on a blanket. None of the blankets tell a linear story. If you look at a blanket, no matter if you're American Indian or, you know, a non-American Indian, if you look at the blanket, they don't tell a story. It's just stuff. It's just geometric components. And if your eye interprets them as mountains or this or that, the designer probably didn't mean that. They were just trying to make a pattern that sells. It's pretty much as simple as that. It's Ralph Lauren or Vera Wang or any other important designer. Their business is selling product. So when Pendleton comes out with a line of blankets, the ones that sell stay in the line. The ones that don't are thrown in a dumpster and they replace it with something else they think will sell. But
I'll take the dumpster blanket if anyone wants to donate.
But getting back to Joseph Rounsley, who is the original designer, he did know American Indians very well. He spent a great deal of time with. He spent a great deal of time with American Indians from what's now called the Confederated Tribes, which is three tribes that live in Pendleton on a reservation. And he spent a great deal of time with those people, but I don't see anything from those tribes that shows up in his blanket designs. What I will concede without question is that certain tribes, it turned out, like certain colors better than other colors. So they would make the coloration of the blankets more saleable. And they definitely did that. And the salesman for Pendleton also spent a lot. The other thing I should mention, let me just go back a little bit. The original Pendleton the second version of Pendleton that still exists today. Originally, they went into business to sell blankets only to American Indians. They realized that that was sort of short-sighted because why wouldn't they sell them to everyone? So they started selling them to everyone.
Okay.
I would say that today about 40% of Pendleton's total blanket output goes to American Indians. The rest goes to, you know, non-Indians. But even today, they don't use sacred symbols. They still use geometric designs. They have for, I would say, the last 20 to 25 years, hired American Indian designers. Just to fight back against the idea that Pendleton has taken all the designs from American Indians. What's actually interesting is the Navajo tribe, which is the only tribe of all the American Indian tribes that takes sheep's wool and makes it into textiles. There have been many Navajo blankets. Their designs have been based on trade blankets designed by white guys. So it's a very interesting mix between the two and how they impact each other.
For sure. Obviously, there is some pushback that we see amongst natives and non-natives, but yet the Pendleton is still so beloved by so many, including myself. And I can see where the controversy can come, but I just wanted to kind of hit that head on.
In most tribal settings, they are given as graduation gifts, as wedding gifts, for christenings. Some tribes still use them as burial blankets. So this is something they see every day. It's such a instrumental part of the culture that it's hard to imagine that they aren't American Indian designs because you see them every day with your American Indian family.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I can see where I totally understand the pushback. And it's very difficult for Pendleton to defend themselves because the people that are speaking the loudest you know, they're quite passionate. You know, they believe that their culture should be protected. And I believe that too. I have zillions of American Indian friends that I've developed over the years. And I have this conversation with them all the time. And it's a conversation that will continue. Pendleton just sounds like they're, if they're speaking, it sounds like, well, you know, we're just trying to protect our company bottom line. But I can speak for them without, you know, without being part of them. So, you know, I'm just an adjunct person that advises them once in a while. But yeah, I don't develop, they don't call me to develop corporate structure or strategy. So they should, but they don't. It's a huge part of American culture. Geronimo owned a Pendleton blanket. Chief Joseph owned a Pendleton blanket. You know, it is part and parcel of the American Indian story. Almost all tribes at one point or another use some company's blankets. The other thing I want to mention to you is, because Pendleton is the term everyone uses, their last competition went out of business in 1935. So they are the only pioneer Indian trade blanket manufacturer left standing.
Still standing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But for example, you talked about Killers of the Flower Moon. And I did sell them a large number of authentic pieces for that film. So the Osage women in the 1920s, which is the period of the film, what they preferred were the simplest striped blankets that Pendleton made. They're called a serape style. And they're just very simple. And the lead actress, Lily Gladstone, she wears a couple of the blankets that I supplied pretty much throughout the movie. Mm-hmm. Now, what the men actually preferred were blankets from the Racine Woolen Mill from Racine, Wisconsin. And the Osage men were peacocks because these blankets were really spectacular and far more complex. Mm-hmm. They didn't use hardly any of those in the film because they're extremely expensive to buy and they didn't want to spend the money. So, wow. So I would say in that aspect, the movie from my eyes looks a little skewed, but no one else notices it.
We all know the term Pendleton blanket. However, Pendleton makes many different products and their blankets are an extremely small portion of their revenue from what I've learned from you. And in addition, Pendleton's name is actually Pendleton Woolen Mills, just for those of us who are learning. And there were multiple manufacturers back in the 1800s and 1900s that were woolen mill types. So why don't you tell us more about the several woolen mill competitors out there? You mentioned, I think, J. Caps and Sons out of Jacksonville, yeah. Illinois. There was Buell. What's that list that we should know?
Well, the primary woolen mills were the Racine Woolen Mill that I just mentioned. And to my mind, they made the most beautiful, most finely woven blankets of all. They went out of business in 1912. So they only produced blankets for 20 years, but they're absolutely just state-of-the-art, magnificent. And anyone seeing one today would be overwhelmed by the beauty and the quality of the weave. They're just remarkable. And they used a lot of stars in their patterns. They were just amazing. And they used a certain palette of colors that was also very appealing and still is. They're just classic. So J. Caps, the first company, made very simple but very elegant blankets. They used a type of loom called the Dobby loom. A Dobby loom could not make curvilinear. It could only make straight line component designs. Mm. So their blankets are very simple looking, but very elegant. And you can well imagine an Indian chief, for example, wearing one of these, you know, or someone that was considered very important in the tribe, because these were really cool. And then there were some other companies, and I think probably the most unusual one of all that people know hardly anything about, including me. There's very little information to be had. But there was a woolen mill that was started in Provo, Utah, and the original investor was Brigham Young.
Really?
Yeah, because, you know, the whole thing about the Mormons were they wanted to be sort of a self-contained world. They didn't want to have to rely on the outside world for what they considered staple goods. And a blanket is a staple good, along with other woolens, you know. Right. In Utah, you need to keep warm. Also, this mill made the sacred undergarments that the Mormons wore then and still do now. So this mill eventually went through three or four different name changes, and ended up as the Knight Woolen Mills. And it was owned at that time by a mining tycoon that was Mormon named Jesse Knight. He donated most of the land that Brigham Young stands on today. And they made Indian blankets. And no one knows why. The conjecture is there were a lot of Mormon Indian traders in the Southwest and the Pacific Northwest, but primarily the Southwest. And we only can guess that they asked the mill to make some Indian blankets that they could sell. But there's no catalogs or anything else. Their blankets are very few and far between, the rarest blankets of all, but beautiful.
Really?
Yeah. So there was that mill, Caps. Their biggest competitor, Pendleton's biggest competitor, was a company called the Oregon City Woolen Mills. And they had over 5,000 retail accounts across the country. And they sold Indian pattern blankets. But I should add that all these companies made other things. Pendleton was the only company that went into business exclusively to sell Indian pattern blankets, but abandoned that philosophy almost immediately. All these other companies, Indian pattern blankets were just another product that they made. They made standard bed blankets. They made garments sometimes. They made just anything that was, you know, there were thousands of woolen mills in America in the 19th century. Any place that had a major river had a woolen mill. But only five or six of these companies made Indian pattern blankets to varying degrees of success. The only company that made even remotely Indian designs was a company called Buell Manufacturing, and they were in St. Joseph, Missouri. And it could be argued that they lifted a Navajo design or two for their blankets.
Okay.
But they were stylized. They weren't exactly Navajo. They were semi-Navajo. And so if any company was guilty of cultural appropriation, I would argue that Buell would be the one that you would target. You know, Pendleton, really not so much. I think if people reviewed Pendleton patterns over the years, no one has been able to show me, for example, the art that Pendleton has allegedly grabbed to make that pattern that they're complaining about.
Right.
So that's what's interesting to me. So basically, people sort of pick up the torch and go, oh my God, they're making money from our culture. And right. I understand why they're upset. I really do. But no one has ever shown me an example of something that has turned up in a Pendleton blanket.
Right.
So there's no, I'd like to see the proof. And if someone can supply that, I'll gladly, you know, take a look at it and ponder whether I should pay a lot more attention to that or not. But I've been looking at these things now for 54 years. And other than Buell, I have not seen that sort of direct application of quote unquote American Indian art to these blankets.
Interesting. And I mean, I know our listeners are probably learning a lot too. That was a lot about, there were all these woolen mills. I never really thought about that, and that there were competitors, and that Pendleton really is, we think that it's the only one that ever was, and it really wasn't. There were a lot of them out there, but Pendleton has long survived. Now, how did the Native Americans trade or purchase the Pendleton blankets?
Well, that's an easy thing to answer. When the Indian Wars were over officially in 1890, the government, obviously now they had, you know, basically, you know, they'd been successful in committing genocide and now had, you know, hundreds of thousands of American Indians now on the public dole and confined to reservations. So what they did was they gave licenses to white guys who set themselves up as trading post operators. And they plunked themselves down on the reservations all over the country, and they wanted something to sell. And so what they sold were these trade blankets among the staples that they offered. You know, the trading post became the focal social hub of a reservation because they had all the staples that you needed. They had right. tools, they had saddles, they had everything you needed, but they also had your friends hanging out there. And you would go and hang out with your friends, and oh, if you needed some coffee or if you needed some tobacco, you would get that. Right. And in the Southwest, where the Navajo were weaving, a Navajo woman would bring in her woven blanket, and the trader would say, oh gosh, yeah, I'd really like to have that. And she would probably leave with a commercially made blanket rather than the handmade piece she had brought in to sell.
Wow.
So this has been going on. The handmade
piece would have been more desirable, but.
Well, it's really interesting because I don't think people have considered this, and this is the most fascinating aspect of this whole thing to me, and it always has been. Since basically 1892, when Caps made their first blanket, what has been going on is American Indians have been loving and using blankets designed by white guys. But the Navajo have been selling their handmade pieces exclusively for Caucasian use. I don't know a single Navajo that collects Navajo rugs. Now, there probably are one or two. For example, there's a great artist named Tony Abeda. And Tony collects Navajo rugs, but he collects a lot of things. But if you go into a Navajo home and you see a Navajo rug there, it's on a loom. It's not on the floor. What they have are Pendleton blankets.
So interesting.
So you basically have American Indians creating, you know, Indian, American Indian textiles for white people. And these white guys at Pendleton and white women now as well, you know, selling blankets to American Indians. So it's just this very odd thing. And this has been going on. This has been going on for 125 plus years.
So interesting. And so I always think of, obviously, Pendleton blankets are not cheap. How did they, and inflation is a thing, but what did they typically need to trade to get one of those? Was it silver? Were they expensive
Every tribe sort of had a specialty, you know. Some tribes had beadwork, some tribes had baskets, some tribes had silver, some tribe like the Navajo had their weavings. So whatever the trader thought was of comparable value, they would make a deal. They were called traders because that's what they did. They traded. Wow. So whatever they got from the local tribes, they would have to turn into cash so they could continue to supply their trading post. So almost all the traders ended up speaking, of course, you know, the native languages where they were. And most of them, although I'm sure there were a few bad guys, because there are in every business, but a lot of these traders became valuable members of the community as well and did a lot of things that are beneficial. And there's one trader today who's as white as can be. His name is Mark Winter, and he owns a trading post called the Toadlina Trading Post, which is in Newcomb, New Mexico. Mark is the world's greatest expert on Navajo weaving, without question. There's no one even remotely second. I mean, he's it. And he has run, at great cost to himself, I might add, a trading post for the last 20 plus years. And he basically supports 300 Navajo families, because if he wasn't there, I don't know where they would take their weaving. And he does it, seriously, he loses money doing this, but he does it because it's his passion and he loves weaving. So
that's amazing. So that
so there are some good guys out there still, you know. And he doesn't speak Navajo. And most of the Navajo, what they call the grandmothers, They don't speak English. And so the interpreters are involved. It's really interesting. He's revived. Yeah. He's revived weaving in this area. The particular type of weaving that's done there is called two gray hills. Two gray hills rugs or blankets were the finest woven blankets that the Navajo ever created. As far as stitch count, what they consider tapestry grade is 80 stitches to the inch. Now, a normal commercial weaving is 20 or 30 stitches. So 80 is remarkable. And he had many women. He had some of the grandmothers who could do 120, 140, 160. So these are creative geniuses.
That's amazing.
So yeah, what's interesting is
helping to continue to
cultivate. Yeah, so you know, so these weavers would come in and they'd bring this magnificent thing they had done and they would leave with a Pendleton blanket and a bunch of money and sometimes a new truck, you know, Mark pays well. Say,
hopefully they got a lot out of that because obviously they're so talented and patient and good.
No, Mark pays. Mark paid enough that it encouraged them to weave more. He'd never shortchange them. And he also had a policy where he would buy any young woman's first rug, no matter how horrible it was, because that was his thing. Yeah. So, you know, there are good guys out there. And so he's someone who I think is a person that should be appreciated, and he's the opposite of cultural appropriation.
Right.
Yeah, he's more cultural application. So
right, and promotion.
Yeah, because these weavers had stopped weaving. They didn't have anyone reliable to sell to. So he totally reignited weaving in that area. And it's become, you know, a very, very good thing for the economy. Well, so
cheering on the weavers and cheering him on too.
Yeah.
It's a good partnership, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Now, as we learn more about the Pendleton blankets, you have a fun fact expert tip for us about the corners of the Pendleton blankets. Do tell.
Well, the most valuable blankets are called round corner blankets. And Pendleton made those between 1896 and 1908 under the original ownership that went belly up. So when the Bishop family bought the mill and released their first blanket in 1909, the first thing they did was to square the corners. And I assume they did that to separate themselves from the old company. So people would know there was, you know, sort of a, you know, a new sheriff in town. Right. So the original Pendleton round corner blankets are the holy grail for collectors. There's probably about, I would say about 250 of them that exist in excellent condition. There's others that are, you know, sort of catastrophic, but there's about 250 that are in excellent condition. They bring thousands of dollars for a good one.
Wow. So listeners, if you come across a Pendleton with rounded corners, buy it. Or call Barry, because he'll probably...
Yeah, call me, because I'll advise you what to do with it. They're very rare. And there's other blankets that are extremely rare. So, you know, again, because Pendleton is the only surviving manufacturer, this is what people talk about. But there were blankets made by these other companies that are extremely valuable. And collectors seek them vigorously. And they're very hard, you know. We're talking about blankets that are 100 plus years old. There's no reason for them to have survived. They only really became sort of a commodity probably 30 or 40 years ago. When I first started collecting, the first one I bought, I was a broke college student. I was 22. It was my senior year of college. I was dead broke, but I liked Indian looking patterns. I liked Navajo rugs, but I couldn't afford them. So a Navajo rug that was really nice would be $300 or $400. And I was living on potatoes as a college student. Right. So I went to this garage sale and there was this American Indian looking blanket and I didn't know what it was. And the price tag said 85 cents firm, which I thought was interesting. And so I gave this woman $1.
We're not going below 85 cents.
No. This was a tough person, you know, so Anyway, so I gave her a dollar. She gave me literally 15 cents change. And I walked away with my first Pendleton blanket because it had a Pendleton label. And, but I'd never heard of Pendleton.
Right.
And this is pre-computer. So I called a national operator and I got the phone number of Pendleton. And I ended up talking to a gentleman named Bill Nance who ran the blanket division. And I asked him what I had just bought and he didn't have any idea. And I said, I don't understand.
And he was from
Pendleton. Yeah. I said, I don't understand. Oh. How could you not know? He said, well, we've been making blankets since 1896. We haven't really kept a collection. We've had a couple mill fires where we've lost a lot of valuable information. He said, I can tell you what we've made during the last 20 years that I've been here, but not before. And I said, is there anyone there who can tell me? And he said, no. And that's what sort of ignited my passion. Here was these beautiful things that no one knew anything about. And it's very hard to find a field of art where nobody knows anything.
Unbelievable.
So I started finding other blankets and found these other companies. I would find a label that said Caps. I didn't know what Caps was. So, but it said Jacksonville, Illinois. So I called up Jacksonville, Illinois information, and I asked for the name of anyone with the last name of Caps. And
are you serious?
There were, yeah. And there were a number of them. And I called and I called and I called. And finally, I got a woman on the phone and she said, you're calling about the blanket mill? And I said, yeah. And she said, no one has mentioned the blanket mill in our family for 50 years. And I said, oh, but you remember it. She said, yes, I was there when Buffalo Bill came to get blankets for the Indians and his Wild West troop. She goes, I was 4 years old and I'll never forget it.
Oh my gosh.
You know,
That's
so that
amazing.
Was amazing. Yeah. So it was really fortunate because, again, this is 1969, 1970, 1971, where I'm just starting. There's no other collectors. I didn't hear of another collector for 3 years, not one. And at that time, most of the descendants of these companies were in their 80s or 90s. And I found someone in every family that was that elderly that remembered the blanket mill or had catalogs or even had a blanket. So if I had come along 10 years later, 15 years later, all these people would have been gone. And so a lot of questions still remain, but because I was able to find them, and most of them had all their marbles, they were able to answer a million questions that I never would have been able to find out the answers to. So it was very fortunate Amazing. That I developed this interest at that time.
Yeah. I mean, just think of, and that's what I do with this podcast is preservation of our stories. Same thing. You preserved the stories of these Pendletons as much as you could based on just reaching out to people and
You know, oral history is so important. You know, oral history is so important, especially among cultures like the American Indian, any culture. You know, all you really have regarding your ancestors, if they didn't write things down, which most cultures didn't, is the oral histories, you know, where you know how a particular ceremony derived and why it started and the various factions within a tribe. You know, they were like the Elk Dreamers Society in the Nez Perce tribe. You know, it was just very interesting. And every tribe has a very, very long story that can only really be learned through oral history. And it's just very important to record as much as you can.
Absolutely. Thank you for that message, because that's what I'm always hoping our listeners will take away from this. And you just said a good commercial for that.
Well, you know, elderly people have a lot of stuff in their brain that needs to be transcribed, because
questions, right?
Yeah. Ask questions, because number one, they're probably very glad to tell you. And it also, I think stimulates them and brings back memories for them that perhaps, you know, they wouldn't have come up with on their own. So
true. So true. Now,
yeah.
Did any of those families actually still have some of their blankets from
You know,
the
very few.
Manufacturer?
It was interesting. Hardly any, but what they did have were catalogs. And that was sort of the breakthrough thing for me. Because
Yeah.
after a while, I noticed similarities where I could tell that one company had made a blanket, you know, that I was seeing for the first time. I could just tell from the color palette and the style of pattern. But I didn't know when exactly they'd been made. Or how long they had been in that company's line. So the catalogs, and I managed to find one from virtually every company, were really a breakthrough for me. And after that, it became, I mean, almost, I can do it unconsciously now. If you were holding up a blanket from 50 feet away, I would see a certain color and I'd go, oh, this was made by such and such in the
year. That's so cool.
Well, it's kind of like a car collector. If they see a headlight, they'll go, oh, 36 Dodge. That's all they need to see. You know,
so true.
You know, I bought and sold now at this point over 50,000 blankets. And I've seen many, many more than that. So it's pretty much second nature to me now. But the most exciting thing is when I see a blanket I've never seen before. And that does happen on a pretty regular basis. And there are some blankets still to this day. In both my books, I have an unknown section because I'll have a blanket that I just can't really ascribe to a certain manufacturer. It just doesn't fit their parameters.
Yeah.
So those
That's so
excite me.
Interesting. Do you ever accidentally buy back a blanket you sold years before or anything?
Well, I bought back a lot of blankets. Unfortunately, I buy them back in usually tragic situations. Where it's death or divorce, usually. I had one blanket that I owned seven different times because everyone who owned it got divorced.
Oh, it's a cursed blanket.
Yeah. And I ended up selling it to the Baltimore Museum of Art. And the curator there was a woman named Anita Jones. And I said, Anita, are you in a happy marriage? And she said, well, yes, I am. And I said, well, I have to tell you the history of this blanket. Because this could mean the end of your marriage. And I haven't talked to her in quite some time. So I'm hoping that things are still good at home.
Anita, are you out there and are you still married?
Yeah. So anyways, I said, really, you know, for me to own a blanket, that's a record. I've never owned a single blanket seven times. So,
right. Wow. That's so interesting. Now tell us what that blanket looks like so we can keep an eye out.
Yeah.
Well,
that
in the
was
museum
actually,
now, but.
Yeah, actually, that was a couch cover. Early on, up until about 1915, it was a thing in white people's homes to put a covering over their couch. So this was a Pendleton couch cover. So it was very long, about 8 feet long and about 3.5, 4 feet wide. And they would cover the couch with it. And they made them really for a short period of time. And they weren't wildly popular. They were also easily deconstructed. They would fall apart because people are on the couch all the time. So right. They'd get stained and, you know, and bruised and cut up and, you know, all kinds of accidents would happen. So not that many exist. And so anyway, this was a rare thing, but as you said, cursed.
Cursed blanket. I'm glad it's just sitting in a museum where it can't hurt anybody anymore.
Yeah. Hopefully everyone has seen it, you know, or works in the museum hasn't gotten divorced because of it.
Right.
Yeah.
That's too funny. You know, we talked about Killers of the Flower Moon earlier and how you supplied blankets for the movie. How many did they purchase from you? Did you say 50?
Well, it was 60.
60. Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us more about that whole experience. Like, how did they find you? What were they looking for and all that?
Well, I can't really tell you how they found me. I think sort of all roads lead to me when it comes to these particular type of blankets, because I'm the only one that has a massive inventory and I can also guarantee the age. And with Martin Scorsese, being accurate is of incredible importance to him. So he doesn't want to have a car, for example, in a movie set in the 1940s that wasn't made until 1952. So The costume designer that he hired, Jacqueline West, who did The Revenant, and she's won Academy Award. She's very well known. She was tasked with getting blankets that were period blankets. They needed blankets from the time the movie was set in, which was basically 1921, is when they started, but it covered a few years. So they needed someone who could guarantee the blankets were that old. Also, they needed to know what type of blankets the Osage people favored. And so they called, I'm sure, a bunch of people, and those people probably said, you need to talk to Barry Friedman. So eventually they did. And they wanted to rent them. And I said, I'm not going to rent them. That's insane. And she said, excuse me, but you know, we rent everything from prop houses. I said, I'm not a prop house. And I said, I'm thinking, you know, in my head, they're going to have the blankets for a year or two. I'm going to get back, you know, rip blankets, damaged blankets, certainly blankets that need to be cleaned. Oh my gosh, yeah. And I'm very protective of my blankets to the point where it's almost absurd. So I went, no, I'm not going to rent them. And they go, well, we don't buy them. And I said, well, then I guess we just, you know, can't, you know, make this happen. And she called me back the next day and said, okay, we'll buy them. So
what did they do with all of them when the movie was over?
Well, they're now owned by Apple, because originally Paramount was doing this film, but then I guess they changed direction and did some kind of deal with Apple. So Apple actually owns the blankets, and I'm sure also some of them probably disappeared from the set from people who desired them, or perhaps were given as gifts, you know, to the major actors or actresses, or even the minor actresses and actors who were in the film, or tech people. I have no idea. You know, once I sold them the blankets, they didn't advise me about what was, you know, happening with them. So, yeah. I think the important ones, like the ones that Lily Gladstone primarily wore, either she owns them, hopefully, or they're being kept somewhere, because now they're worth a huge amount of money, far more than I sold them for, because they're iconic. So,
yeah, for sure.
Anyway, so they came to me, and as I said, I told them that the Osage men like these really expensive Racine blankets, so they backed off of those. But what the Indian women liked, as I told you, the Osage Indian women liked, were these very, very simple Serape-style blankets. So I only had 7 of them because, you know, these are 100-year-old blankets in perfect condition. Those are not easy to get. And I told them that they would need far more. And so they called Pendleton, and Pendleton made blankets for the film. So what you see in the film is a mixture of truly antique blankets of the period and reproductions that mimic those blankets.
Cool.
And what was interesting, this again speaks to Martin Scorsese and what a just maniac he is for authenticity. They put 1920s labels on the blankets that Pendleton made for the film. And trust me, there's no way. I've seen the film now 3 times just to look at my blankets mainly. And you can't see a label. Yeah, you cannot see a label on camera. So the fact they put 1920s labels on these things to appease Martin Scorsese, I think, tells you everything you need to know about, you know, his attention to detail.
Right. I love that. That just gives me even more respect for him and what he does and for that movie. For folks who haven't seen the movie, go check it out, Killers of the Flower Moon. It's about the story of the Osage during what they call the Reign of Terror, and a time when Osages were being murdered. And I won't give away any more than that, but there's a whole mystery to it. And very good movie, well done. And the Osage were part of consulting for the movie and the way that it was portrayed and how their people were portrayed. Now, one of the blankets was made into a jacket that Leonardo DiCaprio wore in the movie, right?
Yeah. And I saw When I saw the movie, I saw him wearing this blanket slash jacket. And I go, God, that looks really familiar. But I couldn't place it. And I thought about this and I thought about this. And then finally, I found a photo that I had sent the movie payroll office. I found a picture of blankets I had sent and right. needed to be paid for. Well, this jacket was made out of a blanket that I had sold them. And it was a very heavily damaged blanket that had okay. been passed by. I had this thing probably for 25 years. And every collector who ever came here said, no, no, that's too damaged. I don't want that. And it was really rough. And anyway, so, and because it had sat here for so long, and I really have an enormous amount of blankets, and I don't look at them every day. And I'm old now. I don't remember everyone exactly, you know. So, you know, this sort of just, it looked familiar in the film, but I just couldn't place it. It was just really, it was just driving me crazy. And then I realized, oh my God, here's this picture. I sold them the blanket that they made into this jacket. And what was also interesting was, as soon as the movie came out and the jacket got attention, it was knocked off by 300 clothing companies.
Oh my and gosh, being, really?
Yeah, within days of the movie coming out, it was being offered all over the internet.
Oh.
Yeah,
and
it was amazing.
That came from a torn up blanket, you know, one yeah, man's junk
a torn
is another
up,
man's
totally
treasure.
Totally unsaleable blanket of no historic importance whatsoever. Ugly. Oh. I think it's an ugly jacket, to tell you the truth. But, you know, if you're Leonardo DiCaprio and you're, you know, I guess, you know, whatever you touch becomes golden. You know, if
That's
I put on
so
the jacket,
true.
If I put on the jacket, people go, oh, my God, you're an eyesore. Could you just leave the room? You know, if he's wearing it, oh, God, where do I get one? You know, so it does make a difference. You know, so.
Well, and that jacket, actually, I'll place a photo of that on my Native Chalk Talk Facebook page.
Yeah.
So y'all be sure to check that out. Now, on another note, you also have worked with Ralph Lauren. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, Ralph Lauren has been buying blankets from me for over 30 years. But I should tell you that it's not Ralph who does the buying. It's his buyer.
Okay.
So I've never even met Ralph. I've been invited to his ranch in Telluride, Colorado. But you're only invited to his ranch when he and his family are not there.
Are not there. Okay.
Yeah. So you're invited.
Those look amazing of his ranch. Oh
yeah.
My gosh.
So my blankets are everywhere at his ranch. I mean, they have bought literally thousands of blankets from me over the years.
Wow.
And most of them are bought for resale. They have some stores called Double RL, which are vintage stores.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And there's not a lot of them, but they take my blankets there and sell them hopefully at a profit. They must
right.
because they keep buying blankets from me. But there are a lot of blankets at his ranch, but you know, there's maybe 100 at the ranch, but they bought thousands and thousands of blankets from me. I couldn't even begin to guess a number.
I wonder how many blankets are actually out there in general.
I always wonder myself, they're really difficult to find. People have no idea because when they come to my house, I'll see 300 or 400. So it looks like
yeah.
they're easily found. I can't even begin to tell you. Every time I sell a blanket, I immediately have seller's remorse because the chances of me being able to replace that blanket are almost zero.
Right.
It is so hard to find them. If you go to an American Indian art show, you'll probably find a good one. You'll find 2 or 3 Navajo rugs for sale. And if I'm not there, there won't be a single trade blanket, not one.
Mm. Wow.
And if there is one, it's in a condition that I wouldn't buy because it's been ravaged. So it's either moth-eaten or, you know, stained or any other thing that can happen to a textile.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're talking about the thousands of blankets that have gone through your place there.
Yeah.
Those are all vintage. So we're just talking vintage blankets, right?
I don't deal in anything made after 1942, but that's almost
okay.
a misnomer because really in 1942 is when the factories were taken over by the government for the war effort. So for example, Pendleton, instead of making Indian blankets, they were making army blankets. They were making sleeping bags. Well, I actually misspoke. It was before that. In 1942, they began production again. But at that time, they reduced the number of blankets in their line tremendously. And they seemed to make nothing but brown blankets for about the next 20 years. So they weren't of interest to me at that point. So most of the blankets I buy and sell are made between 1892 and 1930. So I'm looking for blankets that are 90 plus years old in excellent condition. And it's almost an impossibility. If I was a smarter businessman, I would do something else. Because these, you know, I can't order these from a catalog. So seriously, every time somebody buys one, I'm happy, but I'm also devastated.
Right.
So it's a very mixed feeling. Yeah.
I bet. Well, let's talk more, just because I'm so curious about some details and the history of the Pendleton blanket. How were the older blankets made, like dyes, and where did the dyes come from? And
dyes are all synthetic dyes, aniline dyes. Those became available the late 1890s. And that's what allowed all these companies to make blankets in almost any color that they could conceive of. Again, the early blankets, the very early Pendleton blankets, as I was talking about the calf's blankets, were very simple patterns, pretty much straight line patterns. The really complex curvilinear patterns didn't come until later, after 1900.
Okay.
Pendleton got their first jacquard loom, and a jacquard loom are looms that can really do sophisticated designs. They didn't get their first jacquard loom until 1901, but they didn't make all their blankets on that loom. They were still using the older loom. So you don't really see the really wild, spectacular patterns until, oh gosh, more like 1910 or so. Before that, they're quite simple, but in many cases, really beautiful, simple, but gorgeous. So I love those blankets. Those appeal to me more than anything.
Oh, I bet. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Stay tuned for part two coming up. Thanks for listening to Native Chalk Talk. Be sure to join our community on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And check us out at nativechalktalk.com. Stay tuned for the next episode. You're going to love it. Yuk-uk-ki. Thank you, my friends.